start of interview with Mrs. S. A. Wickramasinghe. 21st of September 1967.
If I may ask something just for the record. I believe you represented an MP between 47 and 56, is it?
No, I'm very bad at dates, but I know those are wrong. From
52
to 56.
Oh, I see. If I may go back to the 30s, I'm rather interested in the Suryamal campaigns and the type of people who participated in that activity. I presume most of them were radicals anyway, though not all would have been left-oriented. Is that correct?
Yes, well, of course the idea of a left movement hadn't really started then, but the main people were young people who'd come back from England. Of course, Colwyn and NM, Robin Ruxnam. Then there were some local lawyers. Ari Jatilka was there, strangely enough. He didn't keep up his left orientation very long, but at that time he was there. He was a school teacher at the time. Then I was actually employed as a teacher and was able to interest all our staff in it. So they actually made the paper flowers, the Suryamal, and they helped in the collection.
Where was
this? That was run on the Bali for Vidyalaya. Nearby, yes, Borella, Maradana. You must have already the list of people. If I thought very hard, I could give you names of other people, but I'm sure you've already got those.
I'm not looking for a list as such. I was interested in what one might call the class structure. I was wondering whether it was largely middle class, upper middle class.
Well, yes, because we hadn't really organized workers very much in anything at that time, had we? It was right at the beginning.
Was it very much an urban movement? I mean, I wonder.
Yes. Started in a small way, chiefly Colombo.
I wondered how far it spread to places like Panadura, Porana, small towns, provincial towns.
Well, of course, Wilmer Pereira, I should have mentioned, he was one of the leading figures on it too, so I've met him. Been in that area too, but so far as I remember, it was chiefly Colombo.
That meant it
And also in one or two other big towns, I think in Martaba too.
That meant
where there were any of us, yes.
It would have been largely confined to the English-speaking.
Yes, yes.
Going a bit further, I presume you would have helped Dr. Wickramasinghe in his election campaign in 36.
Yes, in 36?
Yes, the Donoghue time.
Yes, 36.
Oh, well, oh, sorry, 31 too.
No, I was just wondering which you meant.
Mm-hmm.
Not in 31.
Mm-hmm.
We were not married then, and although I was in Martara, campaign was carried on quite a different basis from the way campaigns are carried on now, and I had no part in it at all.
Yes, in fact, what I was interested in was the electioneering of that time. 36 too, I presume.
36 you... I took part.
And then later in 47?
Is that the time you stood for a by-election, 47?
No, that would have been earlier in the State Council. No, I was thinking of 47 as the first parliament, first independent parliament.
Well, wasn't that at a time when he was not allowed to stand? You see, unless I look at the dates set offhand, I can't remember.
I know
you will know that probably.
I know he was not allowed to stand. I was under the impression it was after an election petition, you see.
No, he was disqualified for having served a jail sentence. That, if you haven't got the details, you should get, because it's very interesting. They actually altered the law in order to be able to disqualify him from standing. And before they altered the law, there was a by-election in which he was returned to Parliament with a very big majority. But that was only a few months before the general election, and by the time the general election came, they had brought this legislation in which disqualified him from standing.
How did it affect him alone and not affect an Emperera and Philip Gunawardhan and others? Because they too were in jail during the war, yes.
Well, of course, this was a different offence altogether. They were only, he was convicted through the courts, you see. They were only detained. They were detainees, weren't they? So I presume that's the different reason.
Well, with regard to...
But I wouldn't ask you to rely on any of these dates. I may be talking about another election, but I think it would be the 471.
With regard to these elections in early years, I was wondering what form the campaigning took. Was the emphasis on public meetings, or did you have some house-to-house campaign?
Well, both. But of course it was not such an organized campaign then, because the political parties weren't there in strength and well organized. It was very much more on a personal basis. So one didn't feel the same impulses going through the campaign.
By the time of the by-election, anyway, the Communist Party would have been functioning. And I was under the impression that they were far more efficiently organized than the UNP, say.
Actually, the by-election, during that time, I was in England. So I can't tell you anything about how that was run.
Who was his opponent in 36?
36? I think EYD Adaganavardhan. But as I say, you mustn't ask me. I might make a mistake. He was now. Was it Kanangana?
Kanangana would have been in Goa.
No. I think it was...
Wait a minute.
He lost in 36, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
That was to R.A. Kanangana.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely not.
I was wondering what sort of factors counted at that time.
Well, I can tell you one factor. That was the first time that ever, as a group, we put forward a number of candidates. That was the time, I think, that NM stood for the first time. So Vic was the only one who'd previously been in the State Council, therefore he had a bit of a pull, and he campaigned very strenuously in the electorates of the others as well as in his own. In fact, there was very great dissatisfaction with him in his own electorate, because they said he's never there, he's always up in NM's electorate, where they had done work during the malaria epidemic. And he, as a doctor during that time, of course, again, had presumably made something of an impression on the people, because he actually treated the people with malaria who'd been put in schools and so forth. So he went, and NM was not so well known at the time, although he was a very up-and-coming young man and he had his own contacts. But still, Vic was important for him, for reasons chiefly of work during the malaria campaign, and because he was a member of the State Council already. So he did spend a lot of time campaigning outside his own electorate, and that went very much against him. I think he overestimated the amount of time he could legitimately spare to go out. Sometimes he would have an appointment, a meeting, and he would send a message, he was very sorry he couldn't come, and then the next day in the newspapers there would be a report that he'd been speaking at NM's elections. So the people who tried to organise something for him saying, well, what is the good of this, you see, and he let us down, and there was a fair amount of that. So I think it was a miscalculation on his part, very much. He need not have lost that. But he never regretted it. I mean, I was wondering
to what extent Mr. Philip Gunawardhan's influence helped NM in that election, in the sense that I believe he's from that area and his relatives might have worked for NM.
Yes, well, I'm sure that would have helped.
To what extent did Dr. Vikramasinghe's local connections and the fact that he must have had relatives in that area. How far did that help?
That must have helped a very great deal, undoubtedly. I would say even today it helps, not so much having relatives, but the family being well known there and his long, attachment to the area and his work as a doctor. And
what about the influence of the headman? I was wondering, insofar as one can generalize, whether they worked for him or against him?
To vary from district to district. Probably more against him than for him. In his own immediate village area they would be for him, but as you got further afield, the influence of the estate owners and the landed people, who were definitely against him and for the UNP, they would have had a very big pull.
Oh, that's very interesting. Because if I understand it correctly, he also had a little land in that district, at least his family did.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that have helped to establish connections with the landed proprietorship in the neighborhood?
Not very much. His land is not very extensive and it's in small, dispersed lots. There's no estate to employing hundreds of laborers or anything like that.
Is it paddy or...?
Some paddy.
Some cash crops.
Yes. Some coconuts. But no estate as such with a labor force. And of course his ideas then were very difficult for many people to accept, not only the landed gentry, because in those days it was thought to be anti-Buddhist to want old age pensions. They say this is not the tradition of our country. Old people are supposed to be looked after by their children, and their children get merit for doing so, and you're trying to strike at the roots of Buddhism. You find all this in Parliament against his ideas. So it was his ideas now was all accepted by everybody. In those days seemed to be, and were worked up to be, very anti-religion and so forth.
I'm very interested in this headman factor, because I presume that in those days the headman could bring block votes purely by their
terrorism
or just influence.
Yes, they were afraid of the headman. Yes, it would operate to some extent.
There was terrorism too?
Well, not in the sense that you found it now, but there were various pressures brought upon people. And yes, one can say terrorism. I always remember going to an election meeting in these very early days. I think it must have been the 36th election. And somebody tapping me on the shoulder and saying, just come here. And took me to a little building at the back and lifted up a cloth and showed me some knives underneath it. You see, and telling me you have nothing to be afraid of, meaning to say that we're all here with our knives to protect you from the other people on the other side who are expected to come with theirs. So that is a great surprise to me to find that. So evidently there was at least fear of terrorism even in those days.
I was wondering whether it was possible in those days to bribe an electorate, in the sense that you got the local big bucks and the headman, promised them things, maybe gave them money too, and by that means sought to win the election.
Well, even that was there, at least in the beginning, but of course the main way of operating was through these whereabouts impersonation. People would be paid something to go in, not to vote, to bring out a blank ballot paper. Then those would be marked, and a trusted person would go in with, say, 100 and put them all in at once. Those were the ways in which things were done in those days, and there was a very great deal of that, no two words about it. Buses were hired with paid people, both men and women, and taken from one polling booth to another all the way around. And at each polling booth they impersonated the dead and the living who had been asked to stay away, and or they would bring their papers out, whatever the mode was.
But doesn't that need some sort of efficient planning and organization.
It does, but there's no lack of efficient planners.
No, I was under the impression, shall I say, that it was a bit more ad hoc than that, you know, in those days.
Well, by the time of my election, it was worked out to a very fine
art.
Yes.
That's in 52.
Yes, very fine.
So it prevailed then too?
It prevailed then on a very organized scale.
Now this Kanangala who defeated Dr. Vikramasinghe, was he a landed proprietor?
Yes. Mm-hmm. He was the father of this Elian Kanangala who is now here.
To what extent did the support of the Basmudalalis influence that election?
Well, I wouldn't know that very well. It must have influenced you.
Oh.
Yeah. Certainly would have had his influence, because in those days you were allowed to transport voters as much as you liked, and the Basmudalalis were all on the UNP side, and their whole services were at their disposal. That was one of the greatest, handicaps that we had when transport was allowed. It had altered the whole possibilities of an election since the law was reformed, and this sort of thing cannot happen. But would you excuse me a minute?
I believe that at that time, in 1936, the left movement was using the anti-headman system plank. And I wondered how that bore on Dr. Vikramasinghe's relationship with the headman of the area, even the headman of his own village.
I wouldn't like to say that. Vic will be able to tell you so much better. Mm-hmm. I was actually living in Colombo, teaching in Colombo, and I would only go down, you know, around about election time. I was not really in touch very much with the organization and the working of the electorate.
If I may jump to 52, who did you have to contest then?
Sarad Vijayasinghe.
So that was he from that area itself?
Oh yes, he was a very big landowner in part of the actual constituency.
Mm-hmm.
One whole stretch of that was either his or his family land. He was very powerful.
So you won that election, didn't you?
Yes.
It was in the form of a giant killer.
Yes, it was, actually.
Mm-hmm. What factors do you think counted there?
Well, of course, it was an electorate which W.P.A. Vikramasinghe had represented. He had just died a few months earlier. There was to be a by-election at which Doctor was the candidate. And the whole electorate had been worked up very well by the party and so forth. Then when Diasanaka died, they were to have a general election, and this by-election was never held. So Vic decided to take the more difficult task of an adjoining electorate and gave me this one, which was already nicely nursed. So I started off with an initial advantage from that point of view. And then I think my opponent chose a rather weak flank, because his whole argument against me was that I was a holman, you see, and do you want a true Sinhalese blood, Rohuna blood to represent you, or do you want this white ghost? Well, that was just at the moment that the country was preparing in a very large and extravagant and expensive way to receive the Queen here. So I had a wonderful answer. You see, it's funny how these people like one sort of white skin and not another. How is it? And gave them, so long as it's somebody who is upholding the empire and the ruling classes and the exploiters, it's all right for the UNP. But there are other people's white skins who identify themselves with etc., etc. So he hadn't a very big plank there, and I used to be able to poke fun at him for it. So that also, he didn't seem to have any other argument at all.
I presume you spoke in English at the election meeting.
I did. I used to say probably a few introductory remarks in Sinhalese, but I still am not, and was certainly not then fluent enough to make a full speech. But language was not the great issue then. In fact, you were not allowed to speak in Sinhalese in Parliament.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to make that point also.
What about...
Whilst apologizing for not being able to address in their own language.
What about Sarath Vijayasinghe? Did he use English or Sinhalese?
Sinhalese he would have used.
Mm-hmm. But I presume that there were not a few UNP members who spoke in English. Even in that
Well, of course, literature would have been in both languages. It wasn't, as it is now, everything very much stressing Sinhala. So that all candidates, including Sarath Vijayasinghe, would have published literature in both languages. And there may have been, I don't know, I think most UNP and other MPs could speak sufficient Sinhalese to make good speeches.
To what extent did Hedman influence prevail against you in that election?
Well, it must have prevailed quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Because, after all, they have all the contacts. There are very many large estates in that area.
I was wondering whether it was a diminishing influence, say, as compared to 36.
I wouldn't like to say that.
To what extent was personal vilification adopted by that side? I mean, apart from this color factor.
Oh, I think there were a few obscene verses, I remember, which no one would translate to me, and I was very anxious to know what they meant. But you find that in almost all elections, particularly when a woman comes forward, it's the usual tactic. But I don't think there's anything else very much. You see, I came to Martara to be principal of a Buddhist school. That's why I came to Ceylon before I was married.
Mm-hmm.
So that was always used in introducing me to meetings, that I'd come and done a great deal for the Buddhist children and for General Nationalist and Surimal campaign. I was president of that. And so they could show that I had identified myself always with national aspirations and with Buddhist education, so they had not anything very much on me in that.
If I may ask a personal question, what inspired you to come out here and take that job?
Yes, hold on. Well, I was very interested in the... in the East, particularly in the Indian national struggle at the time. I had been working with Krishna Menon in the India League, and through friends I'd made at the School of Economics, many of them Indian, and of course I knew Doctor there, and I felt that I would probably have a more useful contribution to make out here than in England at the time, and I knew that they were trying to bring more Westerners over, particularly for girls' education, and when this job was offered to me, I decided to try it out.
Well, it is clear, of course, that you were, shall I say, radically oriented even in England. Could one go further and say that you were already left-oriented?
Oh yes, definitely.
I was wondering whether any particular books or individuals had influenced your thinking over there in your teenage or...
Well, I came from a very strong Labour Party family.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, my grandfather was one of the earliest socialists in England.
If I may know his name?
Robert Weir.
W-E-I-R?
E-A-R-E. He was one of the original Bristol socialists, where the Labour Party started with Ramsay MacDonald, who is now not such a popular name to mention in the socialist movement, but however, in those days, I think he had a contribution to make, at least started the ball rolling. So I came down in that tradition. Both my parents were very interested politically.
But I thought your father was a government servant.
Well, he was, but he was nevertheless interested politically, although he couldn't actively take part, but my mother did. And then, of course, the School of Economics, I came across so many people. Krishnamenon influenced me a very great deal. He was my teacher in school, and he persuaded my parents to send me to the School of Economics, where he was still a third-year student. So in that way, I certainly was influenced by him.
Has he changed much since then?
Well, of course, times have changed, one has to change, but I think he's a man of great principle, and he's never changed those, and never will.
Speaking about influences, did Lasky have any influence at all?
Well, in the way he did, he was sort of a reigning spirit over the School of Economics then, and of course he did in that way, but I hadn't much personal touch with him. No influence more than through his works, of course,
mm-hmm.
and his lectures, but not personally.
What sort of personality was he?
Well, you wouldn't notice him in the underground, extremely quiet, and he lectured in a very even, rather monotonous way. He didn't show much emotion, but all very clear, good logic. One enjoyed his lectures in spite of these things. Little humour, spoken in a humorous way.
Another sphere which I thought I would ask some questions on is the role of the member of parliament vis-à-vis the constituents and the administration. For instance, when you were a member, I wonder what sort of pressures you had to face.
From the constituents?
Yes.
Well, I don't know what you mean by what pressures from the constituents. What do you really mean?
I mean, shall I say, requests which
yes.
you expected to channel and act
yes,
on,
yes.
and you know.
Oh, well, of course, there were requests from the schools, for example, in which I was very interested. I kept in close touch with all the schools and through that with the whole area. And then requests for repairs to roads and bridges, all the normal things, requests for things for the hospitals. And of course individual requests of one kind or another, people who hadn't got their pensions. And
now, with regard to hospitals and roads and those sort of things, were you expected to come to the centre and buttonhole people and lobby?
Yes, sometimes go to some of the ministries. But of course there's this district coordinating committee, which used to meet quite regularly, and which I always found really quite interesting. There the whole problems of the whole area were discussed, and one used to put forward one's demands on behalf of constituents for things in the area, get them listed, try to get them moved up the list and so forth.
Oh, that's very interesting. You felt that these district coordinating committees were useful?
Well, I don't know how useful. They're useless to air your grievances at least, and to learn what is going on in the whole district as well as in your own area. And you could always meet people there very easily. The inspectors of education were there, and the PWD and the various people. You could always worry them a little. I know the education man told me the first meeting after I returned from a brief holiday abroad, he said, "Mrs. Vikramasinghe, when you were away, I too had a holiday." Meaning, you see, that you can get at them and nag them, and in the end you get something just because you're, the nuisance. You're such a nuisance that they try to give you an extra teacher here or, some more furniture there, or whatever you're asking for. So,
did the AGA or GA attend this meeting?
Yes, he was in the chair.
I was wondering what the attitude of the AGAs and GAs of the time were. Did they tend to regard these as a bit of a nuisance and mere form.
I really can't tell you how they regarded it. I suppose it was a little change in their normal routine, having all these people together, hearing things discussed and so forth.
No, I was wondering what you felt as an observer, whether there was sympathy or some kind of distance.
No, they were really rather informal gatherings, actually. Everybody knew everybody else, and they knew the district, knew the problems. And,
no, I brought this question up because I'm interested in the administrative structure and also its relationship with the political environment. I know recently people have put forward this plan of district councils, and there is a move of more decentralized administration in which the local people are able to exercise influence. So to that extent, I think it will be an extension of these district coordinating committees, probably giving them more powers and more more authority. Do you think that sort of thing can function?
I think it depends very largely on what the central government is like. Now, for example, in the time I was there, the UNP government, and the thing to do was not to give any assistance, if you could help it, to the in the constituencies of the opposition members.
End of interview of the 21st of September 1967. Start of interview with Mrs. S. A. Wickramasinghe, 22nd of September 1967.
Your local committee wouldn't have a fair chance to judge whether such a committee could be useful in other circumstances. But obviously the people who came to these committees were in a position to know the local conditions.
With regard to this constituent bringing in special requests, say someone came to you and claimed that he had been evicted from the land or made some complaint with regard to land administration, what would your attitude be?
Well, probably I would go in the first instance to see the AGA as he was at the time and ask for his guidance. Put me in touch with the correct thing, because it's very complicated, all these land things, so many different people and different departments dealing with it. So,
no, I was wondering about the question of the veracity of your constituents. You see, some people may have done something wrong.
Oh yes, that you can never take anybody's word for anything without checking up on it very carefully, and even when you check up, there'll be a lot of people who tell the same story because they want to get certain things done. That is one of the greatest difficulties of MPs, even their own supporters let them down very often by telling them some tall yarn, and you go and make representations and are very indignant about it and say something has to be done. In the end you find that they have really led you up the garden path and things are not at all what they seemed. That is something which you learn by bitter experience to deal with.
But I was wondering whether an individual MP can possibly check up on all these demands. It would seem to be impossible.
You mean from everybody in the constituency?
Yes, well, you get...
Well, it is very difficult. But of course you usually have your key men in the constituency, your supporters, who will do the checking up for you and who find out and bring people to you to explain their grievances.
Does the party organization help in this sort of thing, in checking up on...
Well, yes, it should do, because usually usually you have party people in the different areas who are prepared to help you in this. Mm-hmm. It's not possible to keep your fingers on all the things in a constituent unless you have reliable key workers in the different areas.
Mm-hmm. And have you any comments to make on the parliament of your day and the way things were run and on the sort of class structure of parliament of that day, largely an eventy parliament?
Yes, well, of course, English was the only language in which you could speak in Parliament, so that straight away put it on a class basis. It was only those who had been able to pay for their education and could speak English and who could get in. So that was very clear what sort of class basis there was at that time for members. I found work in Parliament rather futile, quite honestly, because it was the accepted practice that nothing a member of the opposition suggested should ever be taken. So it was quite futile ever trying to bring up a private member's motion or anything else, because automatically they would turn it down, even if it was something they agreed with. So there's a general feeling of futility about all the debates. That is why I say I found these other smaller meetings more interesting, because there are at least small things which could be done. It doesn't mean to say that system was really good or functioned efficiently or anything of that kind, but it was at least something which was more worthwhile in comparison to the work in the house.
I would also like your comments on educational policy over the past 10 to 15 years, as you saw it then, and of course the big changes which took place subsequently, and the present situation.
Well, that's very difficult to say, because so many things have been started and then abandoned and then gone back to something else. I would have to think much more carefully to see exactly how it came and comment on it.
No, but I presume you were in favour of taking the schools over.
Yes, mm-hmm. Definitely.
Why?
Well, in order to give more equality of opportunity. Mm-hmm. That is absolutely basic, isn't it, to all socially.
So you felt that even under the free education system there was no equality of opportunity?
Well, not if you still have some schools which, because of the money they can commandeer, gives a superior education.
Doesn't that prevail to some extent now, too, with the continuance of a few private schools?
Yes, I think it does.
And what comments have you to make on this controversy about having English as a second language?
Controversy on having English as a second language?
On maintaining English, you see.
As a second language?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose it's very difficult for me to look at that objectively. Not from a personal point of view, but I still feel that if you were to outlaw English altogether, you would lose a very great deal, because you just haven't got yet and won't have in the foreseeable future so many facilities which you can get through English. I can see that English is used now as a vested interest here, which I would be against. But I think you can tackle that probably in other ways. It should be tackled in other ways. It should not be allowed, certainly, to remain the force it has been in the past.
I was wondering how the sort of language issue and the changes which have taken place and increased emphasis on Subhasha influenced the Communist Party itself. I presume that in the early days, with when everything was done in English, and when the leadership and, shall I say, the politically oriented groups were largely English-speaking, the party too conducted its business in English. I'm not sure.
Well, first of all, I'm not a member of the Communist Party, so I can't really speak for the Communist Party. But English was used very much more in the past. It's continually being ousted in the party, as in all public and other institutions. And quite rightly, I think. I'm absolutely in agreement with that. In fact, in... trying to think of the date. I think it must have been in about the very early 1940s. A few of us got together and we started a kindergarten school where the medium of instruction was the mother tongue, whether that was we had English, Sinhalese and Tamil. Mm-hmm. And I think we were the first school which did that on conviction that that is the correct thing. It was a fee-paying school. In the past, if you paid for education, of course, you expected to get English for it. And if you couldn't pay, you had to have Sinhalese or Tamil. But here we started on the conviction that the only correct educational principle is the mother tongue. And we did start that.
If I may take another topic, I do not know whether you were involved in this, namely the Hartal of 1953.
I was not involved in that.
Now I was wondering to what extent your constituency participated in this movement.
Not to any great extent. It was something which was mostly felt in Colombo, surely.
Well, I know there was trouble down south, you know, Galway's...
Rubgama was a famous place, wasn't it?
Yes.
Where they lay across the road and stop buses and things. Well, you see, Akures is a bit off the main coastal road.
In fact, another question arises. I think it would... left movement leader. I was thinking of a westernized English educated and even possibly urbanized individual who as MP has to deal with villagers. Mm. I was wondering about the rapport with, and about the cultural gaps and the difficulties it entails.
You mean now or in the olden days?
In the olden days.
Well, it was so much the accepted thing. People took for granted that it was the people who'd had the English education and wore trousers who did rule the world and rule the country. So, the reform must have been difficult in a certain way, but then people only expected to beg for a few favours. Parties were not formed or were not vigorous, and the same problems and issues didn't arise at all in those days.
How would it influence the situation now?
Well, I don't think it would arise very much now either, because if you go to Parliament you find so many of them in national dress and speaking Sinhala and not even knowing English or knowing it very little. The type of MP now has changed with the change of the language and also with the bringing in of the electoral reform, whereby you can no longer, by hiring all the buses in the area and all the cars in the area and by buying up votes and impersonating so easily, the whole situation has changed, happily so.
To what extent did caste factors come into elections?
Well, they did and they do.
They still do, don't
they? They still do to quite an extent, I think.
But I was under the impression that...
less and less. One may say, but in certain areas it's still is a strong factor.
Was it openly flouted in those days? I mean, people didn't worry about, they, on the public platform itself, they would indicate what their caste was and maybe even vilify the other caste.
Well, everybody knew. That was the first thing people would privately ask when a candidate came forward. It would always be our people, and don't vote for their people, you see. That was always known.
Because now I know with regard to Agalavatta, they say that the caste factor influenced the vote. But on the other hand, it's a 95% Goigama district. And what is, I think, more significant is that Dr. Kalyani
got so many votes.